Listener discretion is advised.
Sunday Matinee presents The Scales of Justice.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome again to WGBY's boxing broadcast from the Legion Hall here in Seattle. Well, it may be a cool spring night outside, but here in the hall, things are definitely heating up. And with me to help set the scene for you is our boxing analyst, Jake Farmer. Jake?
Thanks, Matt. Well, I have to say this bout coming up may be the best amateur match any of us will see in 1952. The Joe Filippone and his Eagle Time Athletic Club up in Vancouver may have a winner in this kid, Sid Morris, role. I've watched the kid train, and I have to say I'm impressed.
Raw material?
Definite prospect. Man, he's young. He's quick for a middleweight. He's got a real advantage in effect. His old man's a boxing man from way back. He's working in his corner tonight.
Not too many father-son teams in the manly sport, are there, Jake?
Yeah, you got it right there, man. I'll tell you, we all know now how much heart that Seattle own Dan Podlak has, but I gotta say he may be in for a tough night against this slick kid the Filippone's brought down from Vancouver.
Well, boxing fans, we're about to find out. The boxers are in the middle of the ring now, talking to referee Chuck Mattingly. Morris Rose in white trunks with a red slash, and our own dad in Podlak is in his trademark blue trunks. They're back in their corners, and any second now, yes, there goes the bell to start the first round. Morris Rose comes out of his corner smartly. He jabs, misses. He's circling Podlak now. Another jab, misses. Podlak's trying to get in closer, but Morris Rose fast. He's very fast. A jab and a right to the body from Morris Rose. That lands. Podlak shrugs it off. He's moving forward. Morris Rose backs up, throws that jab again. And another right for the...
Short right must have got the Canadian flush on the jaw. I haven't seen a man go down like that in a long time.
Morris Rose just now being helped to his feet by his corner man, his father. That's his father helping him up, and this is sad. Old man Morris Rose crying out there. You can see it.
Well, Matt, boxing's a tough sport. It's always been a tough sport, and it always will be.
An amateur boxing match in the northwestern United States early in the 1950s. One man wins, another loses. The same thing is happening in gyms and halls across North America just about every weekend of the year. But if evidence that emerged in court years later was to be believed, that particular fight laid the seeds for a murder in Vancouver more than 30 years after. My name is Edward Greenspan. And the story you are about to hear has been reconstructed from trial transcripts in the Supreme Court of British Columbia, documents filed in the British Columbia Court of Appeal, and material furnished by Larry Still of the Vancouver Sun.
Scales of Justice, a series recreating real events in Canadian crime, with commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In this episode, you will hear Paul Soles as Sid Morris Rowe and Mike O'Reilly as Scott Forsythe in the true story of The Boxer, written by Guy Gabriel Kay and produced by George Jonas.
Vancouver Sun, City Desk. This better be you, Larry.
And if it wasn't?
I'd hire whoever it was as my crime reporter. Well, what do we have? Is he really dead?
Really dead. Joe Filippone, dead at 70. Murdered in his apartment next door to the nightclub his family owned for so many years.
You sound like bad copy. Christ, I can't believe it. Who would have the guts to shoot Joe Filippone?
Looks like robbery, the cops are saying. Safe was open, but they don't know how much was taken.
Now, who's they? Who's on the case?
Joe Earth and Grant Thompson. No surprise.
The heavyweights. Figures.
Well, it's a heavyweight case. This is Joe Filipponi of the penthouse, after all. There's going to be an awful lot of talk on the street about this one. Maybe more than talk. Which reminds me, get someone to dig up my articles on the Filipponi's own big trial from 6 years ago. The prostitution thing, I'll need them for background.
They all walked on that one, didn't they?
Convicted at trial, acquitted on appeal. They all walked. Joe's not walking anywhere now. It's a bad way for an old man to end.
In order to understand why the murder of Joseph Filipponi shocked and riveted the attention of Vancouverites in September of 1983, it is necessary to appreciate what a landmark, famous or infamous, depending on one's perspective, his nightclub, the Penthouse, was. Since its opening in 1947, the club had attracted a remarkable cross-section of Vancouver society, from blue bloods to prostitutes and their pimps. The Filipponi family had presided over this scene through good times and bad for over 35 years. On Monday, September 19th, 1983, when it was reported that Joe Filipponi's dead body had been discovered in his apartment next door to the nightclub, it didn't take long for the first informer's tip to surface. Interestingly, though, and a reflection perhaps of the awe the Filipponis aroused in their community, that tip did not come to the police, but directly to James and Ross Filipponi, Joe's younger brothers.
I just can't believe it.
Hello?
I have to speak to one of the Filipponis.
You got one. This is Jimmy Filipponi. Who's this?
It doesn't matter yet. Listen, I have some information you may want about your brother's killing.
Well, I'd be very pleased to have that information.
All right. All right, but you have to understand, I had nothing to do with it, nothing at all. I just heard someone talking. I heard something, that's all, and I want to tell it to you so you'll know, like, that I'm not connected at all, that I'm a friend, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do. Well, who was this person? I mean, who did you hear talking?
Not on the phone. You better come here, will you do that?
Yeah, I will. But you'll have to tell me who you are so I can do that. I'm prepared to come right over, wherever you are.
My name's Moses.
Well, Mr. Moses, I'm here. What can you tell me?
You gotta understand, I had nothing to do with it. Just that someone been talking since last fall around the racetrack about robbing your brother of $1 million he's supposed to have had in his safe. And that Joe would have to be killed because he knew this guy.
You knew this guy?
Yeah.
Mr. Moses, I think you better tell me who you're talking about.
Sid Morris Rowe.
Sid? Oh, mother of God, I don't believe it. Joe had an appointment with him last night to fix some taps in the apartment. I mean, I can't believe it after all these years.
James Filipponi quickly relayed this information to the police, and just as quickly they decided they wanted to talk to Morris Rowe. In the 30 years since his boxing career had wound to a close, Morris Rowe had become by trade a plumber, but he was much better known as a regular at racetracks in Vancouver and Seattle. A convivial, generous, free spender when he was in the money, Morris Rowe was also known to be out of pocket more often than not. He was also a patron of the penthouse, regular enough to have a tab and be on the pass list. That same day, Detectives Joe Orth and Grant Thompson left a message at Morris Rowe's Vancouver residence that they wanted to speak to him. At about 10:30 that night...
Joe, it's for you on 2640.
Joe Orth here.
Oh, this is Sid Morris Rowe. I got a message. You wanted to talk to me?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. Do you think you could come down to the station now? I'd appreciate it.
Wait,
of course...
are you insane? I'm way too drunk to drive downtown. No way. Can't do it.
Well, where are you? We'll come out to you.
I'm in the, Wooden Barrel Pub. It's in Burnaby.
We're on our way. We'll see you in half an hour.
I'm Joe Ward,
Vancouver Police. You the manager?
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
We're looking for a man named Sid Morrisrow. You know him?
Yes, sir. He's right over there. Hey, Sid.
Mm.
Come here a sec.
Mm. What is it?
Hello, Sid. I'm Joe Orth. This is Detective Thompson. Can we talk?
Oh, yeah, sure. Tony, we use the back room.
Yeah, no problem. It's over here, officer.
Matter of fact, Tony, you come listen in. Be my witness, whatever this is about. I don't agree with you, Orth.
Yeah, that's fine. All right, Sid. We're investigating the homicide of Joe Filippone. I understand you had an appointment with him last night. I've got some questions for you, and we'll be writing down what you say. Do you understand?
I understand.
All right. What did you do yesterday, and where were you?
I woke up about 11 a.m. First thing, I called Joe. Said I couldn't do his plumbing during the day. I was going to the races. So I went to the track. Got there about the fourth race, stayed till they ended. When I got home, I phoned Joe. I mean, Joe's like father to me. I told him, I went to the races. So he said, when are you coming down? I said, I'll be down about an hour or so. But I never went. I went to the Villa Hotel about 8:30 and I ate. Had 6 or 7 drinks in the coffee shop. Used my en route car. You check that. Left about 10:30, walked home. Took about 45 minutes. Then I went to bed.
Have you ever been to the penthouse with anyone?
Ever been? I go there all the time.
Who was the last person you were there with?
There's a girl named Kelly, a girlfriend of hers.
Anyone else?
Scott Forsythe.
Mm-hmm. Where's he live?
Dad, I couldn't tell you. Comes here once in a while. Met him at the racetrack.
Okay, well, I think I'm going to ask you to come with us now. I think we should check out your story. I want to go to this Villa Hotel.
Am I under arrest?
Not at this time.
What if I say I won't go?
We'll make that decision when it's necessary.
Well, then make it, because I ain't going nowhere with you fuckers. I know my rights. Think you're so smart, so tough, Ward, with the big hunk as your partner. I could take you both on. Arrest me if you want. Go ahead.
Sid Morrisrow, you're under arrest in the investigation of the murder of Joe Filippone. You're not obliged to say anything, but be advised that anything you do say will be taken down in writing and may be used against you. You have a right to speak to counsel.
A quick arrest, to say the least. It was to be followed, as it happened, by a quick release the next afternoon. The police count on the public's ignorance of the law to detain people in this way without charging them with a crime. They have no right in this country to do so. Orth and Thompson, at this point, really had nothing on which to hold Morrisrow, especially when his alibi at the Sheraton Villa Hotel coffee shop checked out. But there was more developing very quickly on this case. A fingerprint had already been found on a shopping bag in Filippone's apartment, a print that was quickly matched by computer to a set on file with the police, a set belonging to a man named Scott Forsythe, the very man Morrisrow admitted having last visited the penthouse with earlier that week. The detectives, not surprisingly, became very interested in Mr. Forsythe, and they caught up with him at the Exhibition Park racetrack 4 days later on October the 1st.
Ladies and gentlemen, please note Royal Havoc number 5 is scratched in the 7th race. Royal Havoc is scratched
Scott.
In the 7th.
Scott?
Yeah, what do you... Oh. Please, sir.
That's right. I'm Joe Orth, Major Crimes Division. This is Detective Thompson.
Yes. I noticed you guys before. You wanted to talk to me. I was going to come over.
Yeah, that would have been nice of you. Save us running after you like this.
Do you mind coming downtown to headquarters with us?
Yeah, sure. Why?
Fingerprints, among other things, Scott.
Well, Scott, I think you might have some explaining to do, if you can. The fingerprints you just gave us match a print found in Joe Filippone's apartment.
No way. I never been there. Never been in that place.
Prints don't lie, Scott. We had Sid in here earlier this week, but we had to let him go because all we had was a statement that he was supposed to meet Joe that night. You're in a different position, Scott. You've got a problem.
Look, I don't know how you can have my prints because I never been there.
I think you're lying. Murderers lie. Psychopaths lie. Forsyth, you're under arrest.
Forsyth was arrested on a charge of murder, cautioned and jailed in the police cells. A fingerprint was obviously major evidence, but it was unlikely to support a murder charge all by itself. Orth and Thompson were still looking to build their case, and Sid Morrisroe's possible involvement was very much on their mind. Later, in court, Orth testified in response to questions from Crown Attorney C.M. Sweeney what the next step in this intricate dance of police and suspect had been.
Now, Detective Orth, prior to him going off to the cells, you had made arrangements for someone else to be present in the cell in which Mr. Forsyth was placed. Is that correct?
Yes. Corporal Pinault of the RCMP was there in an undercover capacity. I had made arrangements with him the night before. We knew we would be picking up Forsyth on October 1st.
And had you briefed Corporal Pinault on the task you wanted him to undertake?
Yes, but not on the evidence we had.
And why is that?
But we don't normally tell anybody going in that capacity anything. The less he knows, the better it is.
Jean-Yves Pinault was a 14-year RCMP veteran with enormous experience in undercover operation. He was placed in the cell to wait for Scott Forsyth, and a microphone and transmitter were hidden on his person. Everything the two men said over the next 24 hours or so was recorded. Pinault spent most of the time making small talk, getting Forsyth's trust. It was right at the end of their time in the cell together, after Forsyth had been taken from the cell and formally charged before a justice of the peace with murder, that the comments that were to be central to the case were made.
Jesus Christ, they discharged me with murder. I can't fucking believe it.
Do they, do they got the shotgun or whatever that did it? They don't, eh?
No, they got fuck all.
Well, like, you gotta say to them, I got rights like every other hassle in here. Like, you're a nice guy and they screwed around with your life.
Well, so, let them. Assholes.
Hey, Scott, how'd this guy get blown away? Shotgun?
Handgun. Shotgun's too much noise.
A 357?
44.
44 Magnum? Holy shit. That's a cannon. Okay, all right, man.
It was just a 22. It was just a homemade 22. They're not going to get any ballistics out of it.
And how many time? He shot five times?
No, one shot. 8, 9, 10. That's it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And what happened?
I told you enough. They got nothing on me.
It was for dope, wasn't it? You're into the dope, aren't you? You bad.
What? No, I'm not. You know something? Hey, what is that? What is that under your shirt?
What? No, that's nothing.
No, like hell, it's nothing. You're wired. You bastard, you're wired. I don't believe it. Why? What the hell?
Because I am a cop, Scott. You guys, get down here right now. Come and get me out.
Jesus.
Now watch it, Scott. Keep cool.
Jesus, if I got a lot to learn. Look, none of it's true. Nothing that I told you. I had you figured for a cop when I first walked in here.
Hey, Scott, listen. Don't take the fall all by yourself. It's not worth it. Don't take the fall alone.
There's nobody else involved.
Yes, there is. Don't do it. Don't take it alone. In one day, you'll waste your whole life.
There's nobody else.
Jean, you okay?
Yeah, he's cool.
Well, hello, Scott. You want to talk to me now?
Orth, I gotta hand it to you, you weasel. Didn't think you was that smart.
Just doing my job. You're in deep now, Scott. Really deep. Are you gonna take this alone? Or are we gonna have a talk?
What? Well, what about?
Sid. Your pal Sid, who's out on the street while you're hanging here alone by your balls.
Can I have a cigarette?
Yeah, I think we can manage that. Come on, Scott. All right,
rate, Scott, before we start, I want you to understand that you are not obliged to say anything, but that anything
don't
you do
say... Don't stop Thompson.
Be...
You farmer, you've given me that goddamn warning five times.
We're just doing our job, Scott, like I said before. Now, what do you want to tell us?
It was Sid's idea. He hit me with this plan to rob Joe a while back. I told him that I wasn't interested. He said he really needed the money. I told him to do it himself. Give me another cigarette. Anyhow, I lost a lot of green at the track and partying too hard. I couldn't pay my room bill. They seized my clothes. So when Sid asked me again, I decided to do the job. Sid got me the gun and he called Joe and he said he was coming to do this plumbing thing. But I went in myself to the old guy's apartment. I did the job and I cleaned out the safe. And like, there's only $1,000 or something in there, you know, next to nothing. Sid told me to say 8, 9, 10, you're out when I did it.
When you did what?
When I shot Filippone.
Forsythe's indictment was changed to first-degree murder, which arises if a killing is planned and deliberate. On a first-degree murder conviction, Forsythe wouldn't be eligible for parole for 25 years, as opposed to 10 years on second degree. That fact would have a lot to do with strategy and tactics in the trial to come. In the meantime, Orth and Thompson were still unsure about whether they could make a case against Sid Morrisroe. By the rules of evidence, Scott's statements would not be admissible against Sid in a trial. On the other hand, in the week Forsythe's charge was announced, Morrisroe and the police were talking a great deal, mostly about a possible polygraph test, and Detective Thompson was taping all his calls.
So, what's going to happen? What?
Well, we're still investigating, putting it together, you know?
Well, I don't think the kid's guilty.
Why not?
I don't know. I met him at the track. He's not a bad kid. I don't think he's got the jab, the guts to kill someone.
Well, we're going with what we got. Are you coming in to do that polygraph?
Jesus, all you guys think about that polygraph.
Sid, we've been trying to run into you sober so we can get it done for almost 2 weeks.
Okay, we'll do it. I got nothing to hide. I still don't think the kid's guilty. He's just a young kid.
He's 25 years old, for Christ's sake. You know, there's a cab driver who says he saw you and Scott leave the Sheraton Villa together that Sunday night.
Oh, so now I'm the hitman or what?
Well, are you guilty?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Sure I am. Guilty of what?
Involved in this here homicide.
Look, I never had fuck all to do with it. I don't know nothing about it. All I did was promise Joe to do some plumbing, and I never showed up, and now they're going to hang me for that.
Well, we hear lots of things, you know. Hear about how much money you owe on the street. We got a town full of information on this one. You know a guy named Ed Moses?
Ed Moses? Yeah. Yeah, I know him at the track a couple of times. Haven't talked to him in months. Why?
No, I'm just wondering.
Jeez, you still think I'm a gangster? You still trying to hang the Sid? You guys trying to hang the Sid for fuck all?
Yeah, well, we'll run this polygraph, eh? And then we'll see what we think after that.
Trying to hang the Sid for Joe, and he was my friend for 30 years.
Let's do the polygraph, Sid. We'll pick you up on Friday, okay? 11 o'clock at the villa, all right?
Yeah, okay. I'll be there.
Sid Morrisroe never did take a polygraph test. In the meantime, although Sid was busy trying to convince the police that Scott Forsythe was innocent, Forsythe, of course, had already confessed to shooting Joe Filippone. Not only that, he had agreed to help Orth and Thompson try to make their case against Morrisroe. He made a wiretap call ostensibly from the phone outside the chapel in the Vancouver Remand Center.
Hello. Be careful what you say.
Why?
Because you never know. The phone may not be clean.
Well, I'm at the mission. The only place here I knew I could get a clean phone. And you got to answer me a couple of questions.
Okay. Look, All they're doing is a guessing game.
No, no, Sid, listen to me. They got me charged with first-degree murder now. It's not second degree no more.
Just don't answer no questions.
That's easy for you. I'm the one that's being held.
I know.
Like they got me under their control.
They're
here.
Just playing games, trying to charge like two innocent guys because they go to the track together.
Well, listen, boy, because it looks like they're not playing games with me here. Like this is a first-degree murder charge.
Well, they got nothing on you, man.
Yeah, but like they come at me and they say they got my fingerprints. I mean, that goddamn Fat Thompson, the farmer, he says we can put you right at the scene of the crime.
Hey, watch these phones. They're deadly. Listen, I told them. I said you got an innocent guy in jail. I mean, a man with your capability would never use a gun anyhow.
Yeah, that's right. Like
I... If you wanted to kill someone...
Yeah, I could do it with my goddamn hands and my feet.
Yeah, hands and your feet, yeah.
Yeah, but they don't understand that. And, Sid, they're messing with my head here. They got me so hyper I can't even
see. Just relax. They got nothing. Just give them your name, your address, your age. Don't say nothing more to them.
Now, what are you telling me? I'm the one that's inside. You're walking around out there. Man, I hope you're right, because...
Now, listen, Scott. God, strike me dead if everything isn't A-OK. I'd put my life on the line for you. I'd go the route for you. You know that.
Oh, Christ, look, Sid, the guard's knocking. I gotta screw up.
Hey, you got my word. Everything's OK.
Yeah, I gotta hang up. Bye.
Bye.
It was certainly a call that could establish a close connection between the two men, but was it enough to link Morris Rowe to the murder of Joe Filippone? The police, in consultation with the Crown Attorney's Office, decided they had enough. Among other things, they had several witnesses who would place the two men together in the Sheraton Villa later in the evening that Filippone was killed. 2 weeks after the tape conversation we have just heard, on October 21st, 1983, Orth arrested Sid Morris Rowe and charged him jointly with Scott Forsyth with first-degree murder. There was still no question, though, that when the matter came to trial before Chief Justice McEachern and a jury in May of 1984, the Crown had an obviously better case against Forsyth than against Morris Rowe. At the same time, Crown Attorney Sweeney did have one major witness he hadn't known about at the time the charges were laid, a witness who only approached Orth and Thompson during the preliminary inquiry and who then gave evidence at the trial.
Would you state your full name, please?
Denise Morris Rowe.
You are presently 27 years of age, and your mother was married to Sid Morris Rowe back in 1967 when you were in grade 5 or 6. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you are aware from speaking to your stepfather, Sid Morris Rowe, that he and your mother no longer live together?
Yes, since August of last year.
All right. I am going to ask you to turn your mind to Saturday, September 17th, 1983, 2 days before Joe Filippone was found dead. Do you recall if you went anywhere that afternoon?
I went to the racetrack at Exhibition Park. Sid had called me and said he had a good tip on a horse and to meet him out there.
And did you find Sid Morris Rowe when you arrived at the track?
Yes, he was sitting in the lounge. And I went over to his table and ordered a drink, and then we started talking. So, what's the hot tip?
Hey, you're just in time. Is this race coming up? Outstruck Casey. Can't miss. Bet all you got.
All I've got. I got $10. That's it.
Don't worry. Don't worry about money, Denise. I have something really big coming down. Unfortunately, two people have to be blown away. But next week, I'll come over. I'll give you $10,000. What do you say?
It must have something to do with the Filippone.
Never mind. You'll read about it on the front page of Monday's newspaper.
Now, why did you make that comment about the Filipponis?
The Filippone name came up quite often in our house. Sid talked about them a lot. He always said there were scads of money lying around.
Now, on the Monday after the killing, would you tell the court what transpired?
I saw the headline about the murder and I was sick. I phoned everywhere, all the bars Sid goes to, trying to get hold of him, and I finally got him at the coach house, and he told me to take a cab and meet him at the Sheraton Villa.
And did you do this?
Yes. I got there about 8 o'clock. He was sitting with his friend Jimmy Arnold, and he just kept repeating the same thing.
Somebody blew Filippone away. Somebody blew Joe away.
somebody blew him away. After 20 years, I finally got even with Filippone.
What did Joe ever do to you?
Somebody blew Filippone away. 20 years ago, more than that, I threw a fight for him. And my dad... Well, Joe was supposed to pay me $100 for it. He never did. He was a scum, a pig, and a pimp. No one will miss him anyhow. You know me, Denise. I always get even.
For rather obvious reasons, Sid Morris Rowe's experienced and highly competent counsel, Richard Peck, had to try to shake Denise's credibility on these issues. Why would she be making this up? Well, Peck had a theory.
Ms. Morris Rowe, you told us your mother and Sid Morris Rowe split up in August of last year. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there had been one child of their union, and that is your 13-year-old half-sister, Tammy. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
And that marriage has now come to an end, and the principal outstanding matters are custody of Tammy and certain financial matters.
Yes.
And this matrimonial breakup can be described as a bitter one, can't it?
Yes, it can.
Now, let me understand this matter. You said nothing at all to the police about what you have told us today until January 19th of this year during the preliminary inquiry, 4 months after the death of Joe Filippone. Is that right?
That is correct.
Why did you wait so long?
Because Sid was my stepfather.
I see. That's the reason. You attended at the preliminary in this matter with your mother on January the 18th, did you not?
Yes, just for a few minutes, though, and...
And your mother introduced you to Detective Thompson at that time?
Yes, she did.
And January, December, January, would mark a time, would you agree, when this bitter matrimonial dispute would have reached a peak in terms of bitterness?
I would say December.
December. Fine. And this bitterness involved one specific issue, which was custody of your half-sister, Tammy.
Yes.
Now, let's look at your evidence here. You say at the villa your stepfather told you, "You know me, Denise, I always get even." Is that something you told us when you were called at the preliminary?
At the inquiry? No.
These are words you have recalled since then.
That's right.
You agree these are words of some significance?
Yes.
Sort of a revenge motive. "You know me, Denise, I always get even."
Yes.
I see. And you say he referred to Joe Filippone as being scum, a pig, a pimp. These are fairly strong words, aren't they? Motive words.
Yes.
Were those words something you told us about at the preliminary inquiry?
No, they weren't.
Well, let's go back to that period when your mother and Sid were in this bitter battle over custody of Tammy. Do you remember a discussion with your 13-year-old sister at Christmas dinner?
I do.
Sid Morrisrow was not there, was he? He was in custody at that time.
Yes.
Did you say these words to Tammy Morrisrow? "Your dad is nothing but a prick. And if I have to get up on a stand and swear on a stack of Bibles, I will still lie and give your father 25 years to keep you away from him." Did you say those words?
No, I did not. I told her... We were quite angry at the time. I told her I could put your father away for 25 years.
You could or you would?
I said I could.
If we can look at volume 9 of the preliminary transcript, my lord, page 483. Miss Morrisrow, do you recall this question and answer? Question, she's a 13-year-old girl. Answer, that is correct. Question, you're a 27-year-old woman. Answer, that is correct. Question, and you told this 13-year-old girl in anger that you were going to put her father away for 25 years. Answer, that is correct.
I didn't say I would. I said I could. I was trying to get across that I knew things about the Filippone murder that she didn't.
You said to her, quote, that you were going to put Sid Morris Rowe away for 25 years, end quote. And under oath, you acknowledged that was true, did you not?
Yes.
Is it true that you said those words?
No.
So this answer under oath was not correct. Is that what we are now to believe?
Yes.
Thank you very much. No further questions.
It might be putting it mildly to say that Denise's evidence was critical to the case against Sid Morrisrow. The Crown was also relying heavily on the testimony of Edward Moses, the man who had created the first opening in the case by calling the Filipponis.
Now, would you describe to his lordship and the jury the discussion on this matter?
Well, Sid told me we could considerably change our financial situation, which was not of the best for either of us. He told me he'd seen $1 million in cigar boxes in the safe of Joe Filipponi. He said we would do it on Sunday night because Joe and his very elderly mother would be home alone. We would gain entry under the guise of installing new taps because he had done plumbing there before. And then he stated that Joe Filipponi would have to be killed because he knew him. That's the best account I can give at this moment.
Now, Mr. Moses, what response did you make to this proposal?
No.
I'm sorry?
I said no. I declined.
Now, although this conversation was almost a year previous to the killing of Joe Filipponi, it was certainly open to the Crown to point out the similarities between this plan as outlined and the actual killing on a Sunday of Joe Filipponi. The motive, on this theory, would clearly have been financial. Nonetheless, the possibility of an older, more emotional motivation kept surfacing during the trial. The Crown called a witness named Kelly Barkoff, a cocktail waitress at the penthouse, who had become friendly with Morrisrow.
Now, where in that penthouse was Sid Morrisrow prone to sit when he was in the establishment?
Well, occasionally he would maybe move around, but most of the time he was in my section if I was working.
Were you ever told by Sid Morrisrow anything concerning his past life as a boxer?
Yes. Sid told me about 30 years ago he'd been boxing and Joe was his backer. Sid was about 19 at the time and he had a big fight. It was either in Tacoma or Seattle. And the orders with the bookies were for Sid wasn't supposed to win that fight. Joe had went and taken $10,000 and betted against Sid and asked Sid to lay down for the fight.
Did Sid Morrisrow express what happened after receiving this request from Joe Filipponi and how he felt about it?
He didn't express his feelings exactly, but he told me he had followed Joe's instructions. And looking up from the canvas, he looked at his dad who was in his corner and his dad was crying. And when he told me this, well, he was almost to the point of tears.
And what about the defense? For Morrisrow and for Scott Forsythe. Well, in Forsythe's case, with his confession admitted into evidence and his attempts to entice Morrisrow into a telephone admission of guilt, there was really only one issue and one chance. His lawyer, Robert DeBoo, called Forsythe to the stand. Forsythe described meeting Morrisrow at the racetrack and becoming friendly with him. Then, on the Thursday night before Joe Filipponi was killed, Forsythe said he and Morrisrow had been drinking at the penthouse, and he was introduced to Joe for the first time.
I remember Joe came and had a drink with us. And after Joe left the table, Sid told me about all the charges that Filipponi had faced in 1977 about living off of prostitutes. And he said he didn't even know how many people Filipponi had knocked off or had knocked off.
All right. And did the conversation continue at that point?
Well, he said there was supposed to be a large amount of money in the safe. Now, I can't honestly say that he gave me a definite figure. He just said lots. And we were supposed to rob Joe on a Sunday night when no one else would be there but his elderly mother. And Sid says it's too bad I have to kill him because he could finger me. You know, meaning himself. And I says, well, Sid, I want no part of the killing. I'll come with you for the robbery, but after the money's in the bag, I'm gone. And he stated he'd look after that latter part himself because of this grudge between Mr. Filipponi and his father.
When was the first time you said yes to this robbery?
The Thursday night previous to the Sunday that it was done.
Had he raised this plan with you prior to that night?
Oh, yeah, we discussed the robbery before, you know, a number of times. The Thursday night was the first time I took him seriously.
And why did you decide that night to go along with this plan?
Well, I had $5.20 to my name that night.
Well, my lord, I don't want to interrupt, but I do have a motion to make or renew, because I've made it before and I don't think what I have to say is going to come as a surprise to you.
The motion, of course, was for severance, separate trials for the two men. Peck's argument was that Morris Rowe was in danger of being convicted, not because the Crown was proving a case against him, but because his co-accused, a man Peck said had no credibility at all, was on the verge of doing so. It was an argument to be carefully considered, because the trial was certainly taking an unusual turn at this point. But after renewed deliberation, Chief Justice McEachern once more refused to sever the trial. The presumption that persons jointly accused should be jointly tried continued to prevail. But what was Forsythe trying to do with his testimony? What defense was this leading up to? Well, remember that the charge was first-degree murder. Forsythe had confessed to shooting Joe Filippone. In defense of his client, DeBoo was clearly trying to bring a possible conviction down from first-degree to second. Forsythe testified that all the planning of the crime had been done by Sid. On the Sunday afternoon, though, according to Forsythe, there was a change.
Sid said that he talked to another person, and that person had said that the less people knew what happened, the less people can talk. And so Sid said he wouldn't be coming with me to the apartment.
And what else was discussed?
He inferred to me that I would have to carry through with the job. I said, Sid, I'm sorry. I'll in no way take part in the killing.
Were you not concerned with being identified if Joe Filippone had been left alive?
Well, I didn't plan staying around for any identification being made. You know, my intention was to obtain the money and discreetly disappear from Vancouver.
And what about Sid's share?
Well, too bad for Sid.
Was there a discussion about guns at that time?
I said, Sid, I don't need a gun. You know, if I want to make him open the safe, I can put him in enough pain, he'll do anything. And Sid said he might not be alone, and who knows, he might have a gun himself. So I said, okay, I take the gun. And so Sid put it in the bag that I was going to carry.
And where did you go?
I went to the penthouse. I rang the doorbell of the apartment beside it, and the door opened, and it was Mr. Filippone. And he said, are you here to fix the taps? And I said, yes, but Sid would be late. And he said, for me to come in.
And what happened then?
He invited me up. He gave me a rye and a 7-Up, which I drank very quickly because I was pretty nervous. And I went into the washroom and I took the gun out of the bag. And then I came out of the washroom with the gun.
Okay, Joe. Okay, Joe, let's have the money.
There's no money here. There's no money here. What the hell is this? Is this some kind of joke?
Look, I got the guns real, Joe. This is no joke.
All right, all right. No problem. There's no problem.
Just open the safe, Joe. Just open the safe.
It's open. Go ahead. I won't even identify you in a lineup.
Did he say anything else?
No. I was just standing right beside him. He turned and looked at me and he said, go ahead. I won't even identify you in a lineup. And then he...
Go on, Mr. Forsythe.
Well, when he said that to me, our eyes seemed to lock. Like he just stared right into my face. He didn't seem nervous. He didn't seem scared. And I freaked. And the first thing I thought of was what Sid had told me about him. And I thought, I'm never even going to have a chance to make it to a lineup. And I believe my quote was, yeah, not a fucking chance. And I just raised the gun and I shot him.
If Forsythe was believed by the jury, or if they had a reasonable doubt on this issue, he would be convicted only of second-degree murder. Because on this account of events, he never planned to kill Filippone. He only did it impulsively,
when the look in the old man's eyes put a fear for his life into him. Despite his earlier statement that he intended to leave Vancouver with the money, Forsythe went on to say that he went straight to the Sheraton Villa, as prearranged, and met with Morrisrow. Cross-examining for Morrisrow, Richard Peck had an obvious point to try to make. The murder was Forsythe's alone. Morrisrow had withdrawn from the plan.
Mr. Forsythe, why did you shoot and kill Joe Filippone?
Because I got scared.
Your plan was to rob him without shooting him and then quickly leave town?
That's correct.
Well, with regard to this alleged plan of Mr. Morrisrow's that you told us about, it was never your intention to have anything to do with shooting Joe Filippone.
That's correct.
Well, what changed?
Well, the fact that Sid backed out at the last minute. I was walking into somewhere that I'd never been before, and there was a lot of things that changed.
Sid backed out on you?
That's right. I don't know if he didn't want to do it anymore, but I knew he was backing out of it.
He was chickening out, in your view, is that it?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, if you never intended to have any part in this so-called plan to kill, why did you shoot Joe Filippone?
I shot Filippone because he scared the hell out of me.
Scared you by staring at you?
That's correct.
Well, what was it about his stare that made you shoot him?
Because I realized that I'd bit off a little more than I could chew, Mr. Peck. I mean, he just wasn't nervous. Our eyes locked and he just wasn't afraid. I mean, I was afraid. I got this adrenaline flow. I was in a panic.
And when did your panic cease?
Well, I'm not sure my panic has ceased completely even now. I have integrity when I performed this.
When you shot Joe Filippone?
Then and after, yes.
Then and after, I see. Yeah. Well, let me summarize this then. On the Sunday afternoon, the man you say is the author of this whole plan is now chickening out.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, if he's backing out, why are you so intent on carrying on?
I needed the money.
And it was your intention to go and get the money and leave town and not share any of it with Morrisrow?
That's correct.
Why didn't you leave then?
Well, because the money wasn't there. I'd done something out of my fear. You might say I was a little upset at Mr. Morrisrow. I didn't know what to do.
And that animosity is carried through to this very day, hasn't it?
Because of other instances, yes, it has, Mr. Peck.
To the extent you told the sheriff that if you couldn't get Morrisrow in jail, you would get him in court.
Yes, but I can elaborate on that
for
you.
The only way you are going to get him in court is under oath, isn't it?
No, it is not.
I see. What other ways do you plan to get him in court?
Well, they have become aware of that, Mr. Peck. That is why they brought us down here separately.
What other ways do you intend to get him if it isn't by lying under oath?
Physical violence, Mr. Peck.
Well, I think I should direct some remarks to both of the accused. Is there going to be any difficulty if the two of you continue to sit together in the accustomed place?
No. I can keep the peace.
Mr. Morrisrow?
No trouble on my part. Never.
Peck's cross-examination essentially revealed the nature of his defense, and he did not call his client to the stand. That ended the principal evidence in the case. When it came time to make their submissions to the jury, Peck's central argument was that the evidence of Denise and of Forsythe himself was overwhelmingly tainted by their animosity to his client, that if any association had existed between the two men, Morrisrow had backed out of it on the Sunday afternoon, and that if Forsythe had indeed only decided to kill Filippone in a panic, then Morrisrow could not be guilty of aiding and abetting such an impulsive, unplanned action. DeBoo, speaking for Forsythe, also painted a picture of a frightened robber performing an unplanned killing. Arguing for the Crown, Sweeney suggested that the evidence of Moses, of Denise, of Forsythe himself spoke to the planning and deliberation of first-degree murder. The men had then met immediately after the killing and divided the meager proceeds. So much, the Crown suggested, for Morrisrow's withdrawing from the scheme. The jury, following the Chief Justice's meticulous charge on the facts and the law, deliberated for almost a full day before returning to the courtroom.
In the matter of Forsythe and Morris Rowe, members of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
Yes, we have.
Mr. Foreman, what is your verdict on Scott Forsythe?
Guilty of first-degree murder.
And what is your verdict as to Sidney Morris Rowe?
Guilty of first-degree murder.
Thank you. Thank you all, ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
Appeals for both men, largely on the issue of severance again, were unsuccessful. Morris Rowe and Forsythe are currently serving their life sentences without eligibility for parole for 25 years. But despite the continued rulings of our court system, the question still arises. Are we following the right path in placing such a priority on trying such people jointly? Surely, there can be few situations as likely to lead to dishonest or distorted testimony as the need to try to exonerate oneself while placing blame on a co-accused. It may well be time to take a closer look at how our courts deal with the problem of antagonistic defenses. The law is a living, changing thing. This may be a place for such a change. In the end, though, in the Forsythe and Morris Rowe case, based on the jury verdict and the evidence heard, we are left with a story of murder and a revenge that took 30 years to be consummated.
8, 9, 10! Morris Rowe is out! What a shocker! 10, Podlak, Dick, the young Canadian in the first round. Great punch. I haven't seen a man go down like that in a long time. Morris Rowe's just now being helped to his feet by his corner man, his father. That's his father helping him up, and, oh, this is sad. Old man Morris Rowe's crying out there. You can see it.
Well, Matt, boxing's a tough sport. It always has been a tough sport and always will be.
After 20 years, I finally got even with Filippone.
What did Joe ever do to you?
20 years ago, more than that, I threw a fight for him. And my dad, you know me, Denise. I always get even.
You have heard the true story of The Boxer, an episode in our series, The Scales of Justice, recreating real events in Canadian crime. The script was by Guy Gabriel Kay, and the commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In the cast, you have heard Michael Riley as Scott Forsythe and Paul Soles as Sid Morris Rowe, with Chappelle Jaffe as his stepdaughter Denise and Neil Monroe as Detective Orth. Also in the cast were Kate Alexander, David Bolt, George Buza, Barry Flatman, Jim Henshaw, Ken James, Francois Clanfer, Sean McCann, Jim Morris, Ken Pogue, Victor Redlick, Angelo Rizakos, and John Stalker as the sports announcer. Murray Westgate was heard as Joe Filippone. Technical operations were by Derek Stubbs, with sound effects by Matt Wilcott. The production assistant was Nina Callahan. Casting consultant for the series is Beth Russell. Original music was composed and performed by Catherine Wilson. The associate producer of the series is Guy Gabriel Kay. The Scales of Justice is produced in Toronto by George Jonas. This is Fred Napoli speaking.